I wish I had smell-o-vision. Is it smell-o-vision? Smell-o-cast.
Smell-o-vision.
Smell-o-cast. Smell-o-pod. Michelle's just painted her nails and we're in a very small room. That's very stupid.
If we get very giggly, you know why.
She just painted her nails and now she can't do anything with her hands. I'm scared that she's going to have a wedgie. I'm going to have to help her out with it. There are boundaries. There are lines that I cannot cross. I love you.
Get this though. I filmed with quite a well-known celebrity that will remain nameless.
I'm going to ask her afterwards.
She told me that her partner pulled her moon cup out for her when it got stuck.
That's love.
That is love.
That's lunar love. Kia ora, hello, and welcome to Bod Almighty,
the practical how-to podcast helping you feel better about your body, have a peaceful relationship with food, and go out into the world with confidence.
Everywhere we turn these days, someone is telling us to love your body. But how?
Well, by listening to this podcast is how.
That's right. We are your hosts, Hannah Tunnicliffe
and Michelle Sokolich. Without further ado, let's get started. Christy Harrison is a registered dietitian nutritionist, certified intuitive eating counsellor, and journalist who has been covering food, nutrition, and health for more than 20 years. She's the author of two books, The Wellness Trap and Anti-Diet, and the producer and host of the podcasts Rethinking Wellness and Food Psych, which have helped tens of thousands of people around the world think critically about diet and wellness culture and develop more peaceful relationships with food.
Today we're talking to Christy Harrison about how to spot the wellness diet and her new book, The Wellness Trap.
Christy, how can we tell if we're actually on a diet? How do we know?
Such a good question. I think it's, you know, if you're feeling controlled or like there are rules and restrictions and you're not allowed to eat when you want, you're not allowed to eat what you want, you're not allowed to eat as much as you want, there's any sort of issue with, you know, types and amounts of foods, that's a pretty good bet that you're on a diet. Now, of course, there are people who have a legitimate food allergy or maybe a medical condition where they have to tweak what they eat. And so that can be a little complicated, right? And I think people in those in that place are definitely at higher risk of disordered eating. People with, you know, diabetes, for example, are definitely at much higher risk of disordered eating than the general population because of having to be mindful of, you know, potentially counting carbohydrates for insulin dosing or something like that, especially type 1 diabetes. So there are legitimate conditions where you might have to, like, be a little bit more aware of what you're eating or maybe not eat certain things. But generally speaking, it's not... that would be for self-care, right? And you're probably not going to feel, well, it's complicated again, but I think for people who have a genuine food allergy, like an anaphylactic allergy or celiac disease or, you know, lactose intolerance or something where they're where they feel really bad after eating a certain food, that can be sort of reinforcing of the decision not to eat the food because it doesn't feel good, you know, and sort of it feels like a self-care move to stay away from the food. But I think where you get into a lot of issues is around wellness culture diagnoses that don't have a lot of good evidence behind them. And so people might think that they're supposed to do something for medical reasons, they're supposed to cut out food for medical reasons, and it sort of, they're told that it's self-care, so they think it should be, and yet they really struggle because there's this huge swath of foods they have to avoid, and usually it's, you know, large chunks of your menu, so it might, it's probably not just one food or one category of foods, but it's all gluten, all dairy, all, you know, certain kinds of vegetables, this and that, the other thing, you know, carbs, whatever, like all these foods are demonized, and often it's in combination. So there's these, you know, combinations of restrictive things that you're supposed to do. So that is a good clue that you're on a diet. You know, I think we'll probably talk a little bit about this separately, but like there are certain diagnoses that are really dubious, that don't have good evidence behind them, that might have a grain of truth to them and sort of explain people's symptoms, but they're not actually real diagnoses. They're not medically and scientifically validated. And the reason people are experiencing symptoms has nothing to do with these supposed diagnoses. You know, the symptoms are very real. It's not all in people's heads, but the labels that get put on what they're going through can be really inaccurate and harmful. And so one example of that is something like adrenal fatigue, which is, you know, a popular diagnosis in wellness culture. A lot of naturopaths or functional medicine doctors might label people as having that. Not all necessarily, but I do see that diagnosis and other dubious diagnoses coming up a lot in those kind of alternative and integrative and functional spaces. And, you know, when people are labeled with that, then often they're prescribed these restrictive diets and lots of supplements and potentially other practices or, you know, products as well. And all of those things can be definitely really restrictive and really put people in the diet mindset and lead into disordered eating pretty quickly, I think, for a lot of people, especially if people are coming in with any sort of pre-existing disordered eating. So it gets really complicated to sort of tell whether you're on a diet, but I think good hallmarks are just, you know, are you told that you're not allowed to eat certain things, or certain things are bad and other things are good? That's a pretty big key. Are you told that you're not allowed to eat at certain times, like intermittent fasting, for example? That's a pretty big sign that you're on a diet. So those are just a few of the big signs.
That's so helpful. And I'm wondering, Christy, why, if you think, yeah, okay, maybe I am on a diet then from what you've explained, and I love how you say it is nuanced, why doesn't dieting work? Why is it problematic?
Yeah, so I think dieting doesn't work for a few reasons. You know, one reason that people are often told to go on diets in the sort of traditional weight loss diet culture is for weight loss, right? Is this idea of weight management and needing to lose weight, you know, supposedly for your health. And the reason that doesn't work is that the body really fights intentional weight loss. It kind of fights weight loss all, you know, across the board, really. We do have these genetically determined set weight ranges that our bodies seem to want to come back to. And if we suppress our weight below them, then the body does tend to fight that and try to fight to get back to its, you know, a weight that it feels more safe at. And so there's a lot of biological processes that happen to drive you back to that set weight range where your body feels safe. You know, you end up hungrier, your hunger hormones increase and stay elevated, your fullness hormones decrease and stay suppressed. You end up having, you know, persistent thoughts of food that drive you to want to eat. Oftentimes people will end up binge eating, and that is really an adaptive mechanism and a way that our species really was able to survive through periods of famine. And so all of these things, you know, there's even like really subtle things like your basal body temperature will decrease, your desire for movement will decrease, you'll do even fewer micro movements that you don't even really have control over throughout the day, all as ways for your body to conserve energy. So your body really fights to get back to its set weight range. And that's one reason diets don't work in the long run. You know, other reasons are kind of more psychological, right? As I alluded to, you know, people will be driven to have persistent thoughts of food and binge eating. And that is really like their body's way of keeping us safe. But it's also, you know, pretty distressing, I think, for people who are going through it. And so in recovery from disordered eating, when people are healing from binge eating and healing from, you know, the restrict binge cycle or, you know, bulimia or other behaviors that involve binging, eating disorders that involve binging, people will, you know, have to let go of those food rules and make peace with food and stop dieting, you know, stop the restrictive eating. And so weight gain tends to be part of that process, you know, part of the process of healing the body, again, getting back to that set weight range that the body feels safe and comfortable at and, you know, it can't really maintain a lower weight than that. And then there's the sort of, you know, the other reasons diets don't work often have to do with the psychology of like the difficulty of resisting certain kinds of foods, right? So when you're told that you can't have certain kinds of foods, those end up being the forbidden fruit that tastes the sweetest. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes too, it's sort of a feedback loop with the physical deprivation and the physical weight suppression that might be happening, because when you're weight suppressed, another one of those physiological reactions that happens is that your body tends to crave more carbohydrates, more high fat foods, more foods that are going to give you quick energy in the form of carbohydrates and like sustained, you know, large amounts of energy in the form of fat. And so the foods that tend to be off limits in diets really tend to be high carb and high fat foods a lot of the time, right? Depending on the diet, you know, sometimes it's, you know, like keto diet, for example, will demonize carbs and lionize fat, but, you know, other diets will do the reverse. Some diets sort of demonize both. And so then you're, you know, kind of really stuck with like protein and vegetables. So, you know, but when that happens, those foods end up having this outsize kind of allure, and like you, it feels irresistible to be around them. You know, the high fat, high sugar foods, high carb foods are the foods that people tend to binge on, are the foods that people tend to gravitate towards when they're deprived of food in general and when they're deprived of those specific foods as well. And so, again, it's sort of part of this whole, you know, drive for survival that our bodies and our brains are working together to get us back to that place where we feel safe and, you know, that we're not going to be starved, right? Like there's really a sense of life and death and survival about this at the level of our body and our brain, even if we're not consciously thinking that, even if we're like, I just want to lose weight to look good for blah, 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 or whatever, right? Because we're bought into this thin ideal and belief system about, you know, bodies having more value if they're thinner. Like that doesn't really register to our bodies. They are much more focused on survival.
Yes. Yeah, that's so fascinating. Can you tell us a bit more about the wellness trap and the wellness culture? Because personally, I know I came to that point where I started to understand all that stuff about diets and I thought, okay, dieting's not the answer. I'm just going to never eat sugar ever again. So yeah, because it's kind of, dieting sort of became a bit out of fashion, didn't it? And now it's kind of morphed into more of this wellness culture. And as you call it in your book, the wellness trap. So can you tell us a bit about what that is?
Yeah, so wellness culture, I think, is really interesting because it really overlaps with diet culture in a lot of ways, right? Like, as you said, you know, avoiding sugar, that's a big thing in wellness culture. And it's considered, you know, it's held up as this path to wellness. In some cases, it's like reducing inflammation or healing leaky gut or chronic candida or like, you know, all of these sort of wellness culture buzzwords. But in fact, it's based on the same system of beliefs, in part on the same system of beliefs anyway, that diet culture is. And then there's some other stuff that wellness culture sort of brings into the fold as well. So, you know, I see wellness culture as this set of values that equates wellness with moral goodness and with certain kind of behaviors and a certain type of body as the path to achieving that moral goodness. And it really overlaps with diet culture. So, you know, as I described in Anti-Diet, my first book, diet culture equates thinness, muscularity, and particular body shapes with health and with moral virtue. It promotes weight loss as a means of attaining higher status, be that, you know, health status, moral status, or social status. I think all of those things are sort of tied up with weight and weight loss in our culture. It demonizes certain foods and food groups while sort of lionizing others. And that is very much sort of an overt part of wellness culture. I think that's the part that we see in a lot of cases, even if the diet part, you know, the sort of body size, weight loss part isn't always like said out loud. You know, that might be the quiet part that they don't always say, but it's really present in like photos and images and, you know, the sort of way that the aesthetic of wellness is still very much tied to thinness and tied to looking a certain way and having a certain body shape and muscularity and all of that stuff. But, you know, it's not necessarily said like, oh, yeah, this is going to lead to weight loss. Sometimes it is, you know, sometimes it's very clear and overt. But I think sometimes, you know, the picture that's painted is much more like you're going to heal your gut and you're going to, you know, reverse your disease and you're going to not have any of these symptoms anymore and heal the bloating or whatever. And, you know, a lot of that is code for lose weight, get thin, especially like healing bloating. And sometimes, you know, there's this sense of like, oh, and the weight will just fall off as you do that, as you heal. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just sort of implied, right? But I think all of those things, and then, you know, the fourth tenet of diet culture is really oppressing people who don't match its supposed picture of health and wellness. And I think we definitely see that with wellness culture, of sort of the people who are painted as unwell and bad and not doing the right things, you know. And wellness culture, wellness, the concept of wellness is really about like always striving to be better, to be more well, to self-optimize. This idea of optimization is really central to wellness. And, you know, so wellness culture really is pushing people towards making all these choices and doing all these things that are going to supposedly drive them toward wellness. And it, you know, really denigrates conventional medicine and holds up alternative and integrative and quote unquote natural and holistic approaches to healing, and has this particular reverence for anything that's perceived as ancient and non-Western, even if those characterizations are not always accurate. And I think that coupled with this sort of individualistic idea of like stressing the importance of the individual's responsibility and, you know, choices, and that you can like control and optimize your health. I think those things together sort of create the conditions for taking cultural, like a lot of cultural appropriation of, you know, supposedly ancient and non-Western and traditional practices that can really like fetishize those practices. And again, you know, it's taking them out of context. So it's not necessarily like the real version of Ayurveda or something that you're getting in a, you know, naturopath's office who offers some Ayurvedic consultations or whatever it might be, right? So, you know, again, not to demonize anyone who is seeking out alternative medicine or providers of alternative medicine, because I think people are attracted to those approaches when they don't feel served and heard by the conventional healthcare system. But unfortunately, I think wellness culture's supposed solutions in a lot of cases can actually do more harm than good, and, you know, are part of this system that is really problematic. Because, you know, this lionization of individual choices, I think, also really downplays and ignores social determinants of health that have a much greater impact on population health outcomes than individual behaviors do. And then there's this other piece of wellness culture, I think, that's really somewhat tied to the individualism, that's like giving anecdotes and social media testimonials and sort of like these stories of like one person bravely fought their disease alone by like giving up conventional medicine and taking all these natural things or whatever. Like, giving those things greater weight than sound scientific evidence, which really enables the spread of mis and disinformation about wellness. Because, you know, scientific evidence definitely sometimes has its flaws, but it is really still the best method we have for sort of teasing out like what's actually an effective treatment, what is shown to be beneficial on its own, and what's the result of a placebo effect, that, you know, people's expectations about something actually have more to do with any healing they might experience from taking the product or the doing the practice or whatever than the product itself.
Mm. Christy, I was thinking about how some people have felt quite marginalized in a medical setting. They've felt like the traditional Western medicine has not catered for them. They've felt left out or unheard, or things have gone unexplained. And I'm wondering if you can talk to how we can be sensitive to that and sensitive to people's needs, their medical marginalization, but at the same time also seek truth and be scientific and critical.
Yeah, that's such a good question. I think, you know, it's really true that people who feel unheard or unserved by the conventional healthcare system are especially susceptible to the harms of wellness culture. You know, so they're marginalized by the conventional healthcare system, and then also in a way, you know, preyed upon or taken advantage of by these wellness practices. And, you know, because when we have frustrating experiences with medical doctors who make us feel dismissed, or like our symptoms are all in our head, or they don't have time for us, it's only natural, I think, to be attracted to approaches that make us feel like someone's finally going to listen to us and take our symptoms seriously and figure out what's going on and really get to the bottom of things. And, you know, a lot of people are really attracted to alternative and complementary and integrative and functional medicine for those reasons. It's like a $413 billion global industry, about a tenth of the $4.4 trillion wellness industry. So, you know, this is popular and it's big business. And I think that, you know, a lot of people just are like feel that they're being given something more and they're being listened to more and having more empathy given to them in an alternative system. And that actually does have value. You know, that's there's something called the care effect, which is part of a family of placebo effects where it's, you know, the sort of mind-body connection is helping people to feel better. And the care effect is very real, and I think is something that conventional healthcare would really do well to bring in more to the, you know, to the fold and to the system. Alternative medicine really has that like care effect
nailed,
pretty locked down in a lot of cases. You know, it really has the jump on conventional medicine that way. I think even despite that care effect, a lot of the actual products and practices and interventions that are given in the alternative and integrative and functional spaces are not effective and sometimes can be harmful in and of themselves, both by creating disordered eating and by, you know, undermining health in other ways too. And so in many cases, that care effect is outweighed by the downsides of those approaches.
And it's really interesting as well, how you say, what was that figure that Hannah wrote it down? Our eyes widened. Yeah.
So the wellness industry, which encompasses, you know, quote unquote, healthy eating, nutrition, exercise, but also all these other segments and sectors.
Yes.
The whole wellness industry is $4.4 trillion globally.
And that's amazing.
About a tenth of it is this like complementary alternative and integrative medicine space.
And I think, you know, speaking personally for myself as well, when you do sort of go down that natural route, you think, oh, I'm getting away from big pharma where it's, you know, the doctors are paid to, you know, give me these pills and stuff like that. And then when you hear that figure, it's like, wow, big wellness.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's this sort of interesting thing that happens. There's this term called malinformation that I think a lot about when I think about this. I learned this term from Seema Yasmin, who's a doctor and writer who studies misinformation. Malinformation is like information that's true, but it's used for sort of nefarious purposes or used to manipulate. And so I think there's a lot of malinformation that goes on in the wellness industry where wellness providers will point out the problems and the flaws with the conventional healthcare system that are maybe true, you know, and there is like pharmaceutical industry influence in the healthcare system, not across the board necessarily, but there are some really high profile examples of it and problematic ways that, you know, pharma companies, for example, in the weight loss sector, right, that pharma companies who make weight loss drugs have influenced policy that, you know, gets enacted to prescribe people weight loss. And so that's really problematic. And that's true that needs to be addressed. But, you know, to take that example and then sort of twist it and say, so come over to us wellness providers, we're not, you know, big pharma, we're not going to just put you on a pill, we're going to get to the root cause of the issue. And we're going to treat you like a whole person. And we're not out for, you know, just for profit or whatever. I think that's really misleading. And I think it can lead people into harm in some cases because, A, you know, it is an industry. Like you said, there is profit there. And B, you know, this idea of getting to the root cause and it's not just popping a pill or whatever actually isn't entirely true either, because a lot of these alternative and complementary and integrative providers will put people on massive amounts of supplements. And the supplement industry is also a massive industry. And, you know, has in the US at least, there's incredible amounts of lobbying that go into getting policies passed, you know, laws passed that favor the supplement industry, such that now this, you know, since 1994, supplements haven't had to be regulated for safety or efficacy before going to market. They don't have to be tested. They don't have to be shown to be effective or safe. They can just be put out there on the market. And there are, in fact, 90,000 supplements on the market, with 1,000 more being added every year, according to one estimate. So, wow. You know, supplement manufacturers are a huge business. It's a huge industry, you know, internationally. And I actually don't know the laws in New Zealand around this, but in the US and Canada, and I think in other countries as well, there's just not a lot of regulation, if any, of supplements. So, you know, they might be able to be pulled from the market after the fact, but they can be put out there with no testing. And, you know, if they harm people, then, you know, kind of too bad for those people, right? Maybe they'll eventually be pulled from the market, but there's nobody sort of looking out for us as consumers ahead of time.
How hungry do you think, Christy, that we are for explanation? I'm asking this kind of in a post-COVID world. We've been faced with this pandemic. There's so much uncertainty globally, economically. I'm just wondering if this kind of drive for explanation is contributing to our investment in this wellness industry. We want answers. Do you see this? Do you see this kind of playing into the wellness industry and how it's being kind of invested in?
I for sure do. And I am someone with multiple chronic health conditions myself and struggled for years to get diagnoses for some of them. And, you know, I really wanted answers too. Like I was desperate for answers. And I think that's what makes so many people vulnerable to this, is that they are desperate for answers and are having symptoms that are curtailing quality of life. I think there's also a piece of it that's, you know, we live in a society, we live in capitalism, right, that pushes such extreme levels of productivity. And also there's, you know, beauty culture and, you know, the impossible beauty standards that people and especially women and femmes are sort of pushed to uphold. And all of that, I think, can also play a role in how we experience our own symptoms. So, you know, thinking about something like bloating or gas, you know, that's something that's not considered feminine or beautiful by conventional beauty standards for women. And so I think so many women get really fixated on digestion and how to eliminate bloating. And then there's the fat phobia piece of it too, of like, you know, bloating can make your stomach stick out and therefore make you look quote unquote fat, and, you know, all of the negative associations that come with that. And so, you know, I think like getting underneath that and sort of seeing some of these systemic pressures on you can sometimes help. I know it did for me anyway, help release some of the fixation and sort of anxiety and just pressure to know and to lock it down that can come with digestive issues. I have IBS, I have GERD, acid reflux, like a chronic acid reflux. I have a hiatal hernia, which is like a physical issue that can cause gastrointestinal problems. So I've been through the ringer with GI issues. And I will say that I've never been less symptomatic than when I've sort of let go of a lot of the pressure to like flatten my stomach and take away bloating entirely and cutting out all these foods to try to do it, when for me and for a lot of people, I think cutting out foods is a you know, form of disordered eating that can exacerbate digestive issues actually.
Yes. And bring breathing. Like you mentioned, like that, you know, holding your stomach in. It's impossible to hold your stomach in and breathe properly, which is also not good for digestion when you're not breathing properly.
That's right. And yeah, it goes back to that beauty standard again of, you know, feeling like you need to suck in your stomach to look a certain way, not giving yourself the air that you really need to breathe, to help, you know, all of your systems work and to help relieve anxiety too, you know. And I think it's all so connected. The mind-body connection is so real. And thinking about, you know, other issues that I've had and people I know have had, like I have a number of autoimmune conditions, one of which is Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which can make me very tired if I'm not, you know, on the right dose of medication. And sometimes even with medication, you know, there's little changes in my thyroid needs that maybe the medication isn't fully addressing and I have to get it adjusted and things like that. So there will be phases where I'm just like a little bit more tired and like having harder time, you know, thinking and forming words. And I can actually hear in some of my old podcast episodes, like when my dose changed and I started talking really fast, you know, versus like some of the other episodes where I'm taking my time. Also, I think I was under a lot of pressure then too, and just like, get it done, you know. But yeah, like, you know, your brain can really be affected by that kind of thing. So, you know, again, I think when I was in my most sort of disordered eating days and like really struggling for answers and trying to figure out, okay, I have this autoimmune condition, but what's the root cause? Like, why do I have it? And can I treat the root cause rather than just going on medication? I found that for me, that was not possible because nobody actually really knows the root cause of most, you know, pretty much any autoimmune condition, I think. And, or most autoimmune conditions, I suppose. I don't think we really know why they exist. And there are all these sort of wild theories based on little grains of potential truth or like really early stage scientific evidence, you know, in the integrative and functional medicine space, especially, I see this a lot, blaming so-called leaky gut syndrome for causing autoimmune conditions, or blaming chronic candida, or, you know, blaming like these things that have no real good scientific evidence behind them. Or in the case of so-called leaky gut syndrome, there's like a grain of truth, but it's really distorted, and it's very early stage research showing a correlation between intestinal permeability in certain conditions, but nobody knows why. And a lot of researchers think it's actually the reverse causation, that the disease itself causes the intestine to be more permeable, and so that's why the connection exists, not that the leaky gut caused the disease in the first place. So anyway, you know, I think letting go, for me and for a lot of people I've talked to, like letting go of that search for answers and letting go of the feeling like I have to get to the root cause and I have to do all these things to, like, you know, heal my gut, heal my body, whatever, so that I can like put my autoimmune disease into remission. That just wasn't possible. And it led me further away actually from the health and the well-being that I was really seeking. And letting go of that and just going with standard endocrinological treatment and, you know, taking my thyroid medication, and pretty much that's it, you know, like going for regular blood work and making sure I'm on top of the dose and stuff. That's been the thing that for me has been the most helpful, and, you know, not this sort of desperate quest for answers.
And you talked to something that I heard out of your interview with Laura Thomas on your Rethinking Wellness podcast. It's an awesome podcast if people want to have a listen. She said, you know, the truth is, and I'm paraphrasing here, that we haven't figured bodies out yet. We don't know how to make them comfortable all the time. Is that something you keep coming back to as a truth that you've had to realize?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's, you know, because again, like this capitalistic system we live in and the way that wellness culture has capitalized on the need for answers, I think we're sold in so many different ways in our culture this idea that like you should feel good all the time, and that it's possible to feel good all the time, and that if you're not feeling good all the time, that there's something really wrong with your diet or your supplements or your, you know, lifestyle, and that you need to fix it and figure it out, right? And yeah, I think it's like a really uncomfortable, difficult reality to accept. And I know for some people who have, you know, even worse chronic health conditions and maybe are disabled by them and feel like they really are desperate for answers, it can be a real challenge, and sometimes maybe not, doesn't feel like the right thing to just accept the condition for what it is, right? The quest for answers and for healing, I think, can feel like you're doing something and can feel like there's hope, you know? But I would just say to anyone who's in that phase and in that space, you know, just to sort of be aware of like how much is the hope helping push you along and sort of keep you going versus maybe the side effects and the unintended consequences of the things you're trying to do. How much is that outweighing any benefit you might be getting from the hope, you know? Because I think at a certain point that balance does tend to tip, and whatever hope and sort of, you know, incentives you might get from continuing to search for answers or continuing to try different treatments and protocols, you know, you might be getting encouragement for that from your community, from your providers, from, you know, things you're reading on the internet or whatever. But if there's a lot of side effects happening from it, including effects on, you know, your mental and emotional well-being and your social life and your connections with people, and, you know, effects on your physical health too, maybe like the effects of disordered eating and, you know, the digestive effects that I mentioned, or, you know, malnutrition related effects or things like that, I think it's really worth considering that the supposed cure might actually be doing you a lot more harm.
Amazing. Christy, thank you so much for your time. That was really, yeah. I'm kind of that last little bit. Yeah, I was like, wow, that's really hitting home for me. So people can find out more about you and your work at christyharrison.com. We'll put all information in the show notes as well, and also about your new book, The Wellness Trap, which I have on order and I'm very excited.
I think actually it's on the 27th in the UK, and it might be also in Australia, New Zealand. So all this week as we're talking. So
very exciting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have been listening to Bod Almighty,
the podcast that gives you practical, how-to steps towards body acceptance and confidence.
You can find us on Instagram at Bod Almighty Podcast.
Please do get in touch to let us know if you have any questions or suggestions. We love to hear from you.
From both of us, thank you and goodbye.